Hello, it's Robert Cartwright from the Institute of Classical Osteopathy. I'd like to do a podcast today on the classical osteopathic approach to chronic pain. This is the first podcast I've done for a while, and apologies for that, but we've been pretty busy at the Institute with the conference that we had in Dorking, which went really well, and we all had a fantastic time with some great speakers and some great workshops, and I know some of you who listened to this were there with us. I think the subject of chronic pain is a really interesting, topical and important one, because for some years now within our profession and in manual therapy in general, we've had this view and opinion being rolled down to us, mainly from our academic institutions. And this idea is that there's this acute versus chronic paradigm. And it would seem that if a patient's complaint is less than 3 months of duration, it's thought that it will cure itself. And if a complaint is over 3 months old, we can't treat it because it's chronic and the patient has central sensitization and they need a different approach than treating the periphery. For example, counseling and centrally acting pain medications, which have their place, but they're not the healthy option and they're definitely not the only option. What is interesting, though, is that students are still encouraged to enrol in these institutions, even though they're now making us appear to be unnecessary. So it's no wonder the big London colleges and colleges elsewhere who adopt this kind of strategy and these ideas are struggling for student numbers. I always enjoyed reading about the facilitated segment. Of course, neurobiology has come a long way since Irving Kaur presented his seminal paper, The Emerging Concept of the Osteopathic Lesion, in 1948, which is well worth a read if you have time. It was a seminal piece of work for its time, and since 1948, there's obviously been a lot of advances in our understanding of neurobiology. And what I want to do in this podcast is attempt to unravel some of the complexity of how our periphery affects our central nervous system, as gaining an understanding of this is an important component of understanding symptomatology and chronicity. And so we understand it, and then we can also explain it to our patients. So going back to this acute versus chronic paradigm, after 3 months, any tissue healing is said to have occurred, and therefore any continuing symptoms are said to have centralized in the central nervous system. Thus, central sensitization has taken place, and therefore treatment of the periphery is not likely to help. But exploring the osteopathic research for the last 60 years and modern pain and neurobiology research, in this podcast I'll demonstrate why this is not correct, and in fact, probably not correct in the majority of cases. My interest in the connection between the periphery and the CNS has always been there, but it was really peaked some years ago when I discovered functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI as we tend to call it, which has been widely used as a research tool, can only visualize the circulatory changes in the large, highly myelinated fibers of the brain, but can't see the pathways leading to these. It then follows that medicine, having that kind of reductionist approach, now having discovered these areas of the brain to be active during certain conditions, such as chronic pain, attempts to treat these discrete localized areas without the thought of why they have occurred or any context relating to that. Hence, centrally acting pain medications. What this is a good demonstration of, though, this high technology advance in imaging, as functional magnetic resonance imaging is this that old quote by John Martin Littlejohn, when he made the statement many years ago that most disease starts on the sensory side. So if most diseases start on the sensory side, that is our way in too. This is part of the reason why passive treatment is so important. It's the way we gain access to delve into the deepest parts of the central nervous system. Modulating sensory input to influence the output. I can't tell you how many hundreds of patients I've seen over the years, and I expect you have as well, that this banal criteria of acute under 3 months and chronic after 3 months doesn't fit for. and that treatment directed at the sensory side has been incredibly successful for them. And patients are incredibly grateful for what we do. To understand the nature of this, we have to appreciate the osteopathic view rather than the medical one. We are a self-healing, self-cleaning, self-regenerating organism, as are all other living organisms on this planet, constantly adapting to try and survive and thrive in the environment we're in. This adaptation to the environment or needs of the organism for survival and procreation can be compared to learning a new skill or training our bodies in some way to follow some pursuit which we actively engage in. For example, if we practice something, whether it be playing the guitar or playing golf or bodybuilding, which is a really obvious one, the more someone weight trains, the more their muscles hypertrophy. Also, the bones strengthen and develop density, and the tendons thicken and get stronger. When people stop doing the activities that create that, the muscles atrophy, the bone density reduces, and etc. So then we de-adapt, because the body doesn't need it anymore. So the more we perform these tasks or activities, the better we get at them. Our body learns how to perform the tasks it believes are necessary for its survival and adapts according to need. Our brain does the same. If you use an area regularly, it develops and grows, such as the amygdala, which has been shown to grow on functional MRI in response to repeated exposure to fear. The more fear we have, the bigger it gets, and it's all incoming from the sensory side. Passive treatment treats both the sensory and motor sides by changing the afferent stimulus into the CNS. A big part of what we're doing with treatment is to adjust or change the afferent input by showing the cortex a more energy-efficient balance of posture by articulating into lesion to show it where it is, and then out of lesion to show it something better or less costly to the body economy. Showing the lesion pattern to that innately intelligent, seeing, sensing, being part of ourselves that is part of the unconscious mind and our sense of self. Hence we have to listen and feel and trust our palpation to allow the body to do this itself rather than impose ourselves upon it. The existing motor output may include what we call symptoms, usually mediated through the autonomic nervous system rather than just pain. This is because afferent sensory input from where the person is at that moment is then compared and contrasted to our sense of self and previous experience and sends out the appropriate motor response, whether it be a muscular contraction or endocrine response, etc. The response is always initiated from the input from the sensory side. And bear in mind that the past or previous experiences are initiated on the sensory side too. The mechanostructural setup is the common maintaining factor for this aberrant afferent sensory information bombarding the central nervous system, which then becomes sensitized. Change that and the situation will change. The body adapts to what it's doing and will de-adapt or adapt again to the new situation. To understand this, we need to review the science behind the sensitization process, which is complex but worth bearing with to get a basic understanding of, so try and stay awake through it. So, sensitization, how does it occur? So the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system are both affected by the sensitization process, but that process is different. Peripheral sensitization involves a reduction in the action potential threshold of the free ends of the small fibre primary afferent system, which are lightly myelinated A-delta and unmyelinated C-type fibres. And these neurons are the ones that become sensitized on the periphery, according to Wolf in 2011. These free nerve ends are present in all tissues of the body, and with the exception of the nucleus pulposus of the intervertebral discs, the parenchymal tissue of the central nervous system and hyaline cartilage of the articular surface of joints, and they're responsible for incoming information from the external environment occurring on the periphery going inwards towards the central nervous system, according to Willard in 2004. Peripheral sensitization occurs because of ongoing stimulus from any structure in the periphery which is innervated by the small fiber primary afferent system. And this can be the skin, muscles, joints, connective or visceral tissues. Inflammation in these structures can cause a sensitization process to occur. And this may be after an illness or an injury has apparently healed, or if these tissues have some ongoing stress, such as congestion or be it lymphatic or venous engorgement, or from postural strain, which can cause that engorgement as well. And the osteopathic spinal lesions, which occur because of the strain, as well as for other reasons. These areas of strain, inflammation and congestion can be present without the organism's conscious knowledge. And we see this in practice commonly when we're palpating tender tissues that the patient was unaware of. But this stimulates the small fiber primary afferent system, causing an increase in firing of neurons towards the central nervous system. Microneurographical research has demonstrated that the small fiber primary afferent system can be active without our conscious knowledge or without us feeling pain, according to Treed in 1992. This would suggest that this ongoing afferentation at a level below consciousness could be caused by some tissues which are under stress or strain and haven't been able to finish the healing process due to these maintaining factors causing obstacles to full recovery. And this could have the effect of causing peripheral sensitization as a knock-on effect, and also sensitization at the dorsal horn of the spinal cord, as the small fiber primary afferent neurons are liable to sensitize when repeatedly stimulated. Central sensitization in the dorsal horn and suprasegmental centers is different from sensitization of the small fiber primary afferents. In the dorsal horn, sensitization occurs with phosphorylation events causing an alteration in membrane characteristics, which leads to gene induction. These changes are usually of a reversible nature, according to Willard in 2004, and also can be useful for learning responses, which are helpful, as well as reflex responses that we find unpleasant and are a factor in poor health. This being reversible is really important to remember, but the appropriate afferent input is required so the previous adaptation is no longer needed. When a potentially noxious event occurs at the periphery, a number of potentially gene-inducing molecules within the small fiber primary afferents are released, which enable sensory information to be passed to the central nervous system. Stimulation of sufficient numbers of these molecules in peripheral nociceptors initiates action potentials, which are conducted through the small fiber primary afferents to the central nervous system. The signal is first conducted to second order sensory neurons in the dorsal horn, and from the dorsal horn to the thalamus, and then to the cerebral cortex via third order neurons, obviously all interconnecting via interneurons, sometimes making us aware of the situation on the periphery, sometimes not. Thus, sensitization on the periphery, in the periphery starts central sensitization in the dorsal horn. It then sensitizes the higher centers. Injury or stress and strain that cause inflammatory mediators to be released trigger neuronal activity and activate several signaling pathways in postsynaptic dorsal horn neurons that mediate the induction and maintenance of dorsal horn sensitization, according to Jansko et al. In 1968 and Zimmerman in 2001. Peripheral nerve damage, for example, instigates the release of the neurotransmitter glutamate and other neuromodulators. Glutamate is the most prevalent excitatory neurotransmitter in the spinal cord and central nervous system, and it acts on a variety of glutamate-sensitive receptors. Whereas some types of receptor are important for the rapid excitatory synaptic transmission of physiological nociception, others such as N-methyl-diaspartate play a critical role in plasticity and sensitization in the CNS. This neurotransmitter activity increases excitability, induces plasticity, and reduces the factors which would normally inhibit excitability, according to Zhao in 2002. Overall, increased sensitivity of neuronal structures is caused by various neurotransmitters stimulated by ongoing afferent input. The protein or peptide products of gene induction act together to maintain heightened excitability and synaptic responsiveness, and thus central sensitization in the central nervous system, according to Zimmerman 2001, Zhao 2002, and Holden in 2003. Thus, glutamate, which is always excitatory, has an important role in sensitization of neural tissue from the first order neurons through the whole central nervous system. Because of this, if sensitization occurs in one area of the central nervous system, it will have an effect further along the neural pathway into the upper central nervous system and cortex, and will not have just a local effect. Or more specifically, sensitized neurons in the periphery sensitize the dorsal horn, where they synapse with the second order neuron, causing sensitization. This sensitization will spread through the multitude of pathways in the brainstem and cortical centers, where the sum action of potentials overbears the inhibitory mechanisms due to the actions of excitatory neurotransmitters. This also has the effect of increasing arousal by stimulating the reticular activating system and stimulating the release of corticotropic releasing hormone, raising cortisol levels via the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, pushing the individual along the general adaptive pathway. And to add fuel to the fire, the presence of cortisol increases the sensitizing action of glutamate. Ongoing stimulation into these sensitized neural tissues also causes excitotoxic cell death. So the inhibitory pathways can be affected by this excitotoxic cell death, so they're unable to overbear this stimulation. To understand a little bit about this, both peripheral sensitization and central sensitization processes, we also need to understand how they're initiated without trauma and without tissue damage as well, which is an important thing, which is really partly to do with how gravity and stress and strain causes adaptive changes to the human structure. So when the human organism adapted or evolved from a quadruped into a bipedal stance, a vast change in stresses and strains occurred throughout this our whole structure. Prushoft, Hyama and Gunther in 1988 demonstrated that the different forces applied to the lumbar spine and pelvis from changing from quadruped posture to a biped posture necessitated the requirement for adaptive changes within these bony load-bearing structures. And you can imagine the whole architecture would have to change, wouldn't it? Additionally, the fascial networks, membranes and connective tissues, which contribute to maintaining integrity of the neurovascular endocrine immune systems throughout the organism, also undergo these adaptive changes. So when we consider gravity, we have to remember that every living organism that exists on our planet has had to develop, mature and flourish under the presence of gravity, or 1G. And structural mechanisms and biology in nature has evolved in response to this. NASA, who are probably the biggest experts in gravity, have spent a lot of time and resources on studying gravity, especially in our little furry friends, rats, who always seem to be the guinea pigs of experiments. Rather unusually. They've also observed the effects on their astronauts and have determined that the effects of the stresses due to spaceflight compromise their immune systems as well as reducing bone density and muscle bulk. These latter findings are an adaptation to the lower need for density in a reduced weight-bearing environment. However, the neuroendocrine or cortisol response is the stresses of taking off, being in space, and generally space travel, and will I get home? those kind of things. Conversely, NASA has studied the effects of rats living in a 2G plus environment and measured an increase in bone density. So if you increase gravity, you get an increase in bone density. You know, our bodies adapt. We know this. Survival of neonatal rats conceived and born at 1.71 grams and 2.03 gravities was substantially reduced. Various other studies show the effects of stress on their immune systems and mechanical changes due to the exposure of increased gravity. So obviously at different sea levels we have slightly different gravities, but it's we have all adapted to survive roughly at this 1G. Studying stress and strain at the cellular level reveals fascinating insights into osteopathic principles as well. Ingber, back in 2003, in his study of the biotensegrity model, demonstrated that even at the cellular level, cytoskeletal filaments both generate and resist mechanical loads and are largely responsible for the cell's ability to resist shape distortion, establishing that even at the cellular level, gravity and movement affects cellular structure. These structural components, which are integral to cellular structure, are also used for transporting enzymes, organelles and substrates. And changes to the cellular structure affect these chemical activities, substantiating a nanoscopic osteopathic principle of structure and function being inseparably related. At this fundamental level, Ingber found structure really does govern function, as cell growth, differentiation, secretion, movement, signal transduction and gene expression all can be altered by applying mechanical stresses directly to cultured cells. Squishing these tiny cellular structures modifies intracellular microfibrils and tubules with effects on their function. And studies demonstrated that they respond by adapting to the load by becoming stiffer. It is thought that these living cells are programmed to stiffen when stress is applied by Ingber's colleagues, Maniotis, Chen and Bojanowski, who found that a mechanical tug on the cell surface integrins receptor can immediately change cytoskeleton organization and alter the arrangement of the molecular assemblies, which is absolutely fascinating. These supporting cellular structures that transport these substances around the cell and from the surface membrane to the nucleus are affected by external stress, and the effect on transport of these substances causes cellular changes and gene expression. Gravitational force has both positive and negative effects. From the classical osteopathic perspective, poor biomechanics causes load bearing in structures ill-equipped to perform the task, causing adaptations made for these postural strains by increasing muscle tone or laying down of fibrous tissue, thickening ligaments, etc. And this leads to inflammation at the cellular level, triggering peripheral sensitization. This also increases allostatic loading, stimulates the arousal system and the hypopituitary adrenal axis, and stimulates the secretion of stress hormones such as cortisol. And as we said, prolonged exposure to cortisol, as well as increasing the likelihood of central sensitization, has a huge array of effects on many, if not all, body tissues, and most of these long-term are degenerative. These structural compensations to gravity affect our cortical reflection of self, more commonly known as our sense of self, which is imprinted on our cortex and is neuroplastic in nature. A component of this is quite often witnessed in patients when you straighten them up from how they're lying down on the treatment table, and then they comment that they feel like they're lying not straight or crooked. The small fiber system is an important route to the activation of the arousal system in the brainstem, where it forms an elaborate network of connections. This activation leads to homeostatic changes throughout the body, according to Menetrier and Besson in 1982, because activation stimulates endocrine, immune and emotional responses to do with arousal mechanisms or wakefulness. The targets of these fibers include the reticular formation, the parabrachial nucleus and the periaqueductal grey, the hypothalamus and the amygdala, according to Tennant in 2013. Some of the neurons which pass to the lower regions of the brain stem send fibers to the medial nuclei of the thalamus and then on to the prefrontal and anterior cingulate cortices, which are the components of and connected to the limbic system, which is the emotional center of the brain. The action potentials in these tracts come from somatic and visceral nociceptive stimuli, and they serve to prevent tissue damage by initiating reflexes involving cardiovascular, respiratory, and neuroendocrine responses, according to Norta and Kuipers in 1958. The effect of these action potentials is of a protective nature to maintain homeostasis and therefore survival, and they have an immense effect on homeostatic regulation and thus general adaptation. The constant barrage of afferent stimulation into the multitude of higher centers from sensitized peripheral small fiber primary afferents involving glutamate and other excitatory neurotransmitters, and in the presence of heightened sympathetic tone, increases the likelihood of areas of sensitization or facilitation forming in all or any areas of the nervous system connected to these structures, according to Kandel et al. In 2000. This information can thus be contrasted with the previous experiences and the motor or efferent reaction formulated, Bremner, 2006. The reticular activating system and locus coeruleus, when stimulated by nociceptive action potentials from the small fiber primary afferent, stimulate monoamine pathways. Even though these pathways have a number of synaptic connections, the effect is still very powerful on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, affecting homeostasis and general adaptation. In 1973, Sato and Smith also previously demonstrated that dorsal horn sensitization alters the output in the ventral horn, which is responsible for vasomotor, pseudomotor, and organ-specific changes in lesioning or somatic dysfunction. From an anatomical perspective, the reticular formation is the area of the brainstem where the cranial nerves connect. And this is also a major target for the ascending visceral and somatic nociceptive fibers. The effect of continued input into these nuclei from the small fiber primary afferents could potentially cause sensitization in any one of these areas, making the nuclei respond and react reflexively to lower thresholds of action potential. The sensitization caused by the incoming action potentials from the small fiber primary afferents with the presence of raised stresses causes increased cortisol levels and stimulates glutamate secretion. This affects neuroendocrine reflex responses, stimulating their target tissues such as glandular, visceral and somatic structures. A motor response appropriate to the incoming sensory information is then sent to the target tissue or tissues from the central nervous system. These appropriate reflex motor responses, if they are extensive enough, cause symptoms, but otherwise, even in the individual who is not conscious of it, it will have an effect on allostatic loading, and the related neurological structures will be affected. This goes some way to explaining an individual's biological susceptibility to whatever they're susceptible to. Like, whenever I get a cold, it always goes to my chest. You know, people who say stuff like that. Oh, if I always get a tummy problem or upset when I'm nervous or things like that. So they normally have a lowered reflex threshold involved in the neurology of that area. In an individual in an adaptive state with high allostatic loads, the barrage of incoming sensory information prevails over the inhibitory systems, and the balance between the two is lost, particularly in the presence of the constant sensory bombardment caused by somatic dysfunction and other chronic ongoing sensory stimulation. This lack of parity between the incoming ascending and outgoing descending responses can be maintained because of heightened activity from interoceptive and exteroceptive stimulation. So long-term, these pathophysiological changes to homeostasis or effects of normal physiology in a system adapting to its environment may produce adaptive changes, leading to an eventual diagnosis of a pathological condition. So if we go back to some of the early research into stress and strain, we can quite clearly see the relationship between the stress and strain and these adaptive changes that occur due to it. So the background of this is from the 1940s when pioneering research was undertaken at the Steele Memorial Research Trust by the researcher John Steadman Denslow, which was published in the Journal of Physiology. Denslow, and later in the 1940s, Irvin Kaur, demonstrated that areas of paraspinal muscle were shown to have increased tone in relation to the muscles of some of the other spinal regions when standing. And these areas of increased tone remained in a state of higher tone when in the non-weight-bearing prone position. It was deduced, after experimentation, that these areas were areas of osteopathic spinal lesioning caused by postural adaptation, loading, previous injury, or viscerosomatic reflexes, or a combination of them, those. These areas varied from individual to individual and were measurable using a pressure meter, which allowed the user to measure the pressure applied to an area to provoke action potentials on EMG, and contrasted to the normal areas as a control. The areas of somatic dysfunction or lesion needed far less pressure to provoke an action potential compared to the other regions, which, when the maximum pressure of 7 kilograms was applied, often didn't respond. By 1944, Denslow had published that results of his experiments had demonstrated strong evidence which indicated that the different thresholds to pressure stimuli were due to both peripheral and central factors. In 1947, Denslow, Kaur and Krems published a paper called Quantitative Studies of Chronic Facilitation in Human Motor Neuron Pools. And this confirmed that the reduction in threshold causing action potentials at lower pressures was a measure of facilitation in the dorsal horn, or what we now know as sensitization, really. In 1948, Kaur published the seminal paper, The Emerging Concept of the Osteopathic Lesion. This was a huge leap for osteopaths, demonstrating the neurology behind this physiological phenomena. What Kaur left out was what happened above in the CNS. He did include this, as he briefly mentioned the other CNS structures, though the study was really limited to the dorsal horn and its facilitation. He also indicated on his diagrams the ascending direction of the impulses and mentioned the telencephalon. But with modern advances in neurobiology and functional MRI imaging, we can now see these higher centres involved in the facilitation. And the impulses don't just pass through this area of facilitation in the affected area of the cord, but create a sensitization pathway to the cortex and back to the target tissues. The afferent input from the periphery doesn't just cause a facilitated segment, it causes a facilitated or sensitized nervous system and becomes the path of least resistance to afferent input. This also affects the somatosensory or cortical map of self, which I mentioned earlier as a sense of self, which is how our central nervous system sees the periphery, which is reflected on the sensory cortex, creating or mapping an image of how our brain sees our body. To summarize, in the healthy, non-compromised individual, there is an even balance between the incoming sensory information, the descending motor response, and the inhibitory systems. An individual who is persistent afferent bombardment into their central nervous system from the periphery releases glutamate and other sensitizing substances which affect the sensitivity of the receptor site to this ongoing stimulation, causing the environment at the receptor site to overbear these inhibitory mechanisms. This afferent bombardment from the incoming first-order neurons causes sensitization at the dorsal horn, according to DeBell and Mannion in 1997, reducing the threshold for action potential sensitivity and ascending the spinothalamic tracts to the brainstem, where collateral branches and fibers are disseminated to a multitude of other structures and nuclei, and stimulates the arousal processes in the reticular activating system and the locus coeruleus. These centers may also be involved in being sensitized if enough action potential create the right environment. This stimulates arousal via the hypopituitary adrenal axis and the secretion of cortisol and adrenaline, which, if sustained, leads to the adaptive state and contributes to persistent excitation at the receptor sites where glutamate-sensitive regions are sensitized, again overbearing the inhibitory mechanisms in the spinal cord, brainstem, midbrain, and the higher cortical centers. Some of these areas of sensitization are likely to be in the central nervous system regions seen using the functional MRI scanning as a research tool, but unfortunately, due to the limitations of this technology, we are still some way from being able to visualize the small fiber pathways leading to these regions. My conclusions from this is that the areas of the brain that have been found to be sensitized or active by functional MRI and are therefore classified as a factor or causative mechanism in a disease process or syndrome are not isolated areas existing on their own, but need to have maintaining factors. To be sensitized, a neural structure has to have a degree of ongoing stimulus. This doesn't always have to be from the periphery. This can be from an anxiety disorder or other psychiatric disorder, or from some previous stressors. The stimulation may be maintained by afferent bombardment from any structure in the periphery apart from hyaline cartilage and the nucleus pulposus. The areas in the spinal cord and suprasegmental regions are sensitized because of the stimulus from the periphery. Again, this doesn't have to always be from peripheral structures, but it's always going to be a sensory stimulus, so that could be auditory or visual. The areas in the periphery that sensitize areas of the cord and upper central nervous system are areas that stress and strain occur due to postural adaptations and to the internal and external environment, weight bearing, etc., previous injury or trauma, and comorbidities. Overlaid on this are the emotional responses learnt from previous experience in the limbic system as an additional stimulus on the reticular activating system affecting the HPA axis, and this also includes the amygdala. These sensitized circuits of the nervous system affect immune, endocrine and visceral structures and therefore are a factor in the homeostatic changes associated with pathophysiology. The effects of gravity on our structure and the strains of our adaptations to it causes or alters the picture of self that we have imprinted at a cortical level. And so the persistent afferentation of neurons that release glutamate are able to sensitize or facilitate, and these sensitized suprasegmental centers initiate a coordinated motor response which either have a long-term unconscious effect on neurologically related tissues, which potentially can lead to pathological change or create symptoms, or both. So really, to complete this, we have to sort of think about some treatment rationales as well. The observed and anecdotal reports of patient improvement we see on a daily basis may also be due to the sensory effects of the tissues, as the effects are still poorly understood and the changes made during treatment having a neuroplastic effect on the central nervous system, down-regulating the central sensitization. Passive articulation of as many conjoined structures as possible with the intention of reducing the strain at the lesion areas has a sensory effect on these cortical regions, reducing the edema caused by strain and reducing the small fiber sensitization. If it's done with a careful and gentle touch and is inhibitory in nature, it will also induce the GABA system, which reduces afferent input of nociceptive stimuli into the dorsal horn, therefore reducing the sensitization throughout the central nervous system. Reducing the stress and strain in the soft and hard tissues permits a number of changes in that area, such as circulation in and out of tissues affected by the lesioned area, therefore allowing restoration of homeostatic mechanisms. We should remember that these changes we've been discussing are a factor in pathophysiological processes. As Kaur stated in his paper, raised sympathetocotonia as a factor in disease, and Hanseeley's general adaptive syndrome. There are other structural adaptations which affect physiology, such as cavity pressures, venous and lymphatic drainage issues, and anything that contributes to ongoing demand on the adrenal glands and raising allostatic loads, as well as psychiatric conditions such as anxiety conditions, or anything that maintains an individual in that fight or flight situation. But this podcast is limited to the effect of the more structural components. Part of a sensible treatment rationale, therefore, would be to assess the obstacles to recovery and reduce the aberrant incoming action potentials from the small fibre system. This will be inclusive of a dietary, psychological and manual osteopathic treatment, as well as other novel sensory type treatments could be included. Removing barriers and rendering unnecessary the causes of central sensitization and encouraging a healthier integration between the central nervous system and the soma will allow a return to homeostasis. In most cases, the neuroplastic changes that occur in sensitization should be a reversible phenomena, but by reducing action potentials in the small fiber system, which may be a maintaining factor in central sensitization. Therefore, the treatment rationale should include reduction of these biomechanical stresses and strains, which lead to events which can have an effect on the autonomic system, such as osteopathic spinal lesion or somatic dysfunction. Professor Bruce Dobson in 2003 wrote, "The manipulation of the sensory experience by therapists and patients may be the most formidable tool for the rehabilitation of motor skills." With this in mind, from the structural perspective, in view that the lesioned areas are adaptations to the effects of physiological and biomechanical stress and strain, it would be appropriate to treat them as effects and deal with the reasons for their presence. In other words, treatment should not take a direct assault on these areas, but rather attempt to improve the structural compensations, whether the causes are somatic or visceral, to reduce stress and strain at the lesion sites, reducing the afferent bombardment into the central nervous system. Therefore, the lesion area isn't treated directly, it's because the lesioned area is a consequence or adaptation to these stresses and strains. The stresses and strains have to be dealt with to really get behind the lesion situation. This would have an overall effect of reducing sensitization and the effect and the efferent motor responses from the central nervous system. And according to John Martin Littlejohn, the underlying principle of osteopathy is adjustment. And this means the total lesion concept, or an audit of what in the patient's life is obstructing their return to health. Bear in mind that this isn't an exhaustive explanation of sensitization or the classical osteopathic approach to it, but underpins why this acute before 3 months and chronic after, therefore needing a different treatment approach as the symptoms are centralized, is commonly a mistaken treatment approach. We have a great deal to offer these patients in helping them return to health or being part of a management strategy for the ones that will only get so far in their return to health. I hope you found some of that interesting. And if you want any more information about classical osteopathy, please go to our website, which is www.classical-osteopathy.org. And thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.